Good afternoon, Council.
Good afternoon.
You ready?
Ready.
All right, next case on calendar is docket number 63394, Demoff versus Sharp. And Mr. Curry, you ready?
Can it please the court, justices, Mr. Richardson. My name is Sterling Kerr, and I am the appellant's counsel, Tanya Demoff. This is our appeal of an order confirming an arbitration award in a matter concerning a two-page letter of intent document that the party signed that had a potential arbitration clause in it. The complaint was filed, Your Honors, back in April of 2008 by Demoff, and the assertion in the complaint was that this letter of intent agreement concerning setting up a real estate office in California had been breached by the respondents, and that there should be a dissolution of the partnership that was potentially created by this document. There was a motion to dismiss, a motion to compel arbitration filed by the respondents, heard by the district court Judge Gonzalez. She ordered that the case go to arbitration. Subsequently, there was another hearing in the fall of 2008 regarding whether or not the arbitration would be binding, because it didn't state in this letter of intent document that it would be binding arbitration. The arbitrator, Jay Young, had a conference in December of 2008, and in 2009, January of 2009, a counterclaim was filed by the respondents, and that's where we start to take issue with the proceedings, Your Honors. The big issue for us is that we believe that the scope of the arbitration far exceeded the agreed-to scope in this letter of intent. The counterclaims filed by respondents contained a number of claims for relief, which had nothing to do with this document, the October 26, 2007 letter of intent. They included civil RICO as a claim. They included a number of other claims, up to 45 pages of counterclaims regarding other real estate transactions unrelated to the letter of intent, other parties. And so at that point in time, unfortunately, counsel that represented my client, Tanya Demoff, filed a motion to withdraw. The motion to withdraw was granted, I believe, court's indulgence here, I think it was sometime in March. Yes, March 5th of 2009. So from March 5th, 2009 on, Tanya Demoff did not have counsel until her new counsel, Mr. Smith, made an appearance, filing a notice of appearance May 6, 2009. There was no arbitration hearing scheduled between May 2009 and the subsequent order confirming the arbitration award, but in August, there was a motion filed by Mr. Smith where he was asking the court to set aside, or asking the arbitrator to set aside a default that the arbitrator had taken sua sponte back in the early part of the year. So, and that was 4 months from the time that those counterclaims were interposed. So our issue is, again, that the scope was so broad and that was so negative and not agreed to by my client. And then the other issue is that a default was entered, a motion to set aside that default was filed by the new attorney, and despite that, and we believe despite a showing of good cause, there was a granting by the arbitrator of a final arbitration award, and that arbitration award was confirmed by Judge Gonzalez.
So, on that application for set aside the default, wasn't there supposed to be it's alleged that the application was deficient because appellant hadn't included a purported affidavit or assertion as to financial conditions?
You're right. There was no discussion in the motion to set aside the default filed by Attorney Smith with respect to financial conditions. He relied on NRCP Rule 55C and the good faith standard, or good cause shown standard that's set forth in Intermountain Lumber. This court's precedent. And he basically set forth language that said that he was unaware of an arbitration date, and because Tanya Demoff couldn't get the file from her prior counsel because of the retaining lien by attorney Christopher Rose on the prior file, that delayed things. And so in the brief, I set forth, Your Honor, that particular section where he stated what he believed to be the good cause shown standard in 55C. So one of the issues that has been brought up by a respondent is that Judge Gonzalez ordered the arbitration, and so the counterclaims which were interposed are somehow covered by the arbitration clause. And I wanted to point out that the dates are pretty important. Judge Gonzalez ruled October 29th and September 2nd of 2008 regarding that the claims of the appellant should go to arbitration. But she never saw the counterclaim before it went to Jay Young as arbitrator. So she had never seen the counterclaim. And so those orders are not saying that the counterclaim should be part of the scope of the underlying agreement that has the arbitration clause. And despite that, the arbitrator went forward, and the arbitrator ignored the motion to set aside the default and entered an award, a default award, on all of these counterclaims against Demoff for a substantial amount.
Counsel, do we have an issue because there was a failure to challenge the arbiter's award within a timely period?
Yeah, I understand that the respondent in his responding brief set forth a claim that somehow it was waived because there was no challenge to the motion to confirm arbitration award. But as I reviewed the statute, I don't find anything that specifically states in NRS 38 that you must oppose the confirmation if there are documents in the record that show that a reading or a review by the district court could find that there was an issue. Let me give you the exact language.
You're basically asking us to look at the common law?
I want you to look at the common law and also the absence of a particular provision in NRS 38 that compels an opposition to a motion to confirm. What we have here is, on the record, a motion to set aside default, where I believe good faith or the good cause standard was shown under NRCP Rule 55C. This court has repeatedly stated in many cases our standard that we like to hear cases on the merits. We believe that the arbitrator, Jay Young, should have set aside the default and allowed the hearing to go forward on the merits. By denying that and then not having any record of that in his arbitration award, we believe that's an error, and it's manifestly unjust. And we believe that the district court, on reviewing and confirming the arbitration award, because that was in the record, should have seen that and should have, at that point, not confirmed the award and indicated, in fact, that the case should have been remanded back to the arbitrator. The other issue that's been brought up has been the jurisdictional issues. And this was an interesting case because after the award, the confirmation of the award, which occurred December 4th, 2009, Tanya Demoff filed bankruptcy. And she filed bankruptcy 30 days after the notice of entry of judgment. So January 6th, 2010, she filed bankruptcy. We argue that the automatic stay under 11 U.S.C. 362 grants relief from the time period to file a notice of appeal within 30 days. And I'm going to reserve some time to discuss that after respondent goes forward. But we also believe that the Bankruptcy Code, Section 108, allows for a person to comply with a state court time restriction for filing a notice of appeal if they do so within 30 days from the day that the case is dismissed or discharged or the automatic stay lifted. And so we believe that we're within the time period because the notice of appeal was filed within 30 days from the date that the case was stipulated to be dismissed, which was May 17, 2013. The notice of appeal then filed June 17, 2013. So I'd like to reserve the rest of this time and we'll argue about jurisdiction.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Richardson, are you ready?
Good afternoon, Honorable Justices, Madam Clerk. My name is Bradley Richardson. I represent respondents James Sharp and Otto Misso. Mr. Misso resides in New York State. James Sharp resides in Illinois. And what I'd like to begin with is the jurisdictional question, which is critical in this case. And our sole reply addressed it. However, our sole reply did not focus on the pertinent subsection of 11 U.S.C. Section 108. I do have copies of it, and if there are any questions, I'd like to reserve an opportunity to brief this singular issue, which I think deprives this court of jurisdiction to hear the appeal. Section U.S.C. 108B applies to a circumstance such as we had here, where there's a pending case, and the party, in this case Ms. Dimoff, files a bankruptcy. And what 108B does, it says that you as a debtor in bankruptcy, you have a time to take your breath and comply with any statutory requirements or statutes of repose or statutes of limitations. We'll give you that additional time if it hasn't already run. In this case, there was a notice of entry judgment served in December 7, 2009 by mail. And the applicable date, including dates of mailing, could very well be January 7th, 8th, 9th, or 10th, 2010. In this case, because of the filing of the bankruptcy on January 7, 2010, and under 108B, Ms. Dimoff was given additional 60 days after her filing of the bankruptcy petition to secure, perfect her appeal of this court's judgment in this case. She failed to do so. And no agreement or contract could ever change that fact. We don't have any such agreement or contract, but there's no way to waive such a jurisdictional defect.
Wait a second. I'm just trying to understand your argument a little better. It was actually January 6, 2010 that the appellant filed a voluntary petition for bankruptcy under Chapter 11. And at that time, there wasn't a stay put in place that she was a debtor. There's an indication that the stay was terminated by stipulation May 16th of 2013.
Well, that doesn't affect her right to pursue her claims and pursue her appeal. That's a different issue than a creditor pursuing an action against the debtor.
But as it pertained to the counterclaims, she was a debtor, right? Or a potential debtor.
Well, Your Honor, as we have mentioned in the Ingersoll case in our SIR reply,
for the arbitration award had already been entered in 2009. So she was a debtor on the counterclaims.
Yes, but as far as the underlying case goes,
okay,
she was pursuing her claim, and the attempt to try to parse this and say that a affirmative defense, a claim for set off or something like that, reverses or flips it on its head, should be disregarded. In fact, under the Ingersoll case and bankruptcy cases, generally, when a debtor initiates an action, and if they're successful or not, they have an obligation to pursue those claims even though they filed. In other words, they have to, the time for them to perfect their rights does not stop. And that's what 108B is all about. That's why it's so very important. This would be analogous to our probate statutes and codes, which provide that when a person dies, if there's a claim out there that has not yet run, they have an additional year to pursue it. So really, fundamentally, she waived and her right to appeal expired as of March 7, 2010. And there's nothing that could resurrect that right. With regard to that bankruptcy stipulation and order, it's interesting to note that Ms. Dimoff was denied a discharge because of her conduct in the bankruptcy proceeding. This is under Section 536, or 523, where the debtor is tainted and not just the claim. It's interesting to note that the bankruptcy court, in entering the stipulation, they went into great detail on why they were denying the discharge. And
the counsel, for the purposes of what you're here for today, is that even relevant to this matter?
Right.
Or were you just, the bankruptcy was filed, it does allow a certain extension of time for doing certain things back in the state court. That's the output of fact we're left right. with on that end,
right.
even though we have a different time frame on the back end with other things.
Right. Very well, Your Honor. Turning to the question of the entry of the award on the arbitration and the judgment, counsel for Ms. Dimoff was frustrated with her lack of cooperation in this case and withdrew. Months went by, and Jay Young, the arbitrator, allowed her opportunity to appear. And it's important to note that when the answer and counterclaim were filed, certainly Ms. Dimoff had an opportunity to challenge those at that time, make any claim back up to Judge Gonzalez, but did not do so. My clients had no choice but to go forward and present their claims to Jay Young. There was a statement by appellant's counsel that somehow we request the arbitration. It was not the case. It was a district court judge's determination that these matters should be submitted to arbitration. So my clients acted diligently in pursuing their counterclaim, presenting their claims. Jay Young gave full and adequate time for Ms. Dimoff to appear. In defense of those claims, she did not. And then I believe the court has queried counsel, appellant's counsel, about whether or not there are any facts to indicate reasonable cause for her failure. There were none that were apparent at the time. There have been none that have been pointed out to this court. That being said, are there any questions I may address of the court?
No. I guess I want to hear just a little bit more on your position as far as her waiver of the ability to challenge the confirmation of the arbitration award.
Well, when the When counsel withdrew, that was Mr. Rose of the Jolly Erger Woodbury firm, Mr. Young gave additional time for Ms. Dimoff to appear, and then we were in turn, we waited on that appearance. It did not occur. No counsel came in for her. So we went forward with the presentation of our claims. I would certainly have liked Ms. Dimoff to have been there so I could have examined her under oath and presented our claims and challenged any defense she might proffer. But she chose to avoid the proceeding. It was obvious that she chose to avoid the proceeding, which was her habit. And now it appears that her actions here are simply a rear guard action. But only, I do not believe that she fears or has any concern about ever having to pay this judgment. We have, my client has spent over $400,000 in attorney fees pursuing the return of $300,000 they laid out, and as a result, they're attending one of her seminars. This has been cruel, it's been frustrating to them, and it's an indication that our civil justice system is ineffective in trying to rectify or remedy situations like this.
Well, I guess my position, and again, your position is that she's waived her right to appeal the confirmation or the arbitration award, and their argument under USC 108C, this time period could have been extended. Yes.
C doesn't apply in this case. That's talking about a situation regarding a non-debtor, which is my client, and their claims. They're simply discharged, and there's an injunction against collecting, but it does not pertain to a situation here, which is a situation under B, where there's an action pending, and the debtor has a later two dates. And the latter, the 60-day period from which they can pursue that appeal applies. But C simply does not apply in this case, nor does A, which is a situation if there were no lawsuit filed. In other words, there was a pending case, had gone to judgment, and a notice of entry of judgment had occurred. And that's a situation we find ourselves in with B, and that's where the debtor has an obligation if they're going to pursue any appeal of the judgment in the pending case has 60 additional days if that statute hasn't run. And this is fundamental, and it is the point that has to be made and clearly deprives this court of jurisdiction to hear the appeal.
Okay, this may be a stupid question, but since a judgment was entered prior to her filing of the bankruptcy, this is the way I understand it anyway, prior to the filing of the bankruptcy action, doesn't that judgment become part and parcel of the estate in the bankruptcy proceedings?
Yeah, well, it's a judgment against the debtor. It's not part of the debtor's estate.
Well, I'm talking about the counterclaim. On the counterclaims,
yeah, my client's counterclaims.
That's right.
Part.
Okay.
Counsel, I guess just a query back. We've been pointing our attention back to 108B, but that scene, and you said you want to possibly provide additional briefing. I'm kind of curious. We've been looking at this really through the eyes of A and C and not B, because B hadn't been previously asserted. Why should we consider anything under that at this time when it previously hasn't been put before us?
Well, Your Honor, this is a rule of law. It's a statute. And we ask that the court consider the entirety of 108C, or 108, including its subparts.
Because this is, you know, this is something that has not been offered previously. I guess I'm a little curious as to the other, though, that the C, which he says is not applicable. Because in our reading of C, if we categorize it, there seems to be an issue. You have 90 days within to do a certain thing. At least looking at what we have, it appears that we've exceeded this 90-day period in the alternative anyway. So that would be a reason for the court to sustain the district court. So I'm just curious as to your position.
If I understand the court, that the court is saying it appears that even under C that the time period has been exceeded. I would agree with that, but there was a more direct subsection that also applied, and that's why I raised that and pointed out to the court today. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Here, I would ask that counsel begin with that last point in terms of the 90-day prohibition and the fact that it was actually 97. Why does that not just end the chase right there?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that 108 subpart C is actually the statute that gives us that reprieve. It specifically states 108C of the bankruptcy code that if there is a deadline fixed by a non-bankruptcy law, or there's an order in a non-bankruptcy proceeding, and the time period to file the appeal has not expired, which it hadn't in this case, because we filed the bankruptcy prior to the 30 days after the notice of entry of judgment, then it says after the stay has been lifted, subpart 2, 30 days after notice of the termination or expiration of the stay, as the case may be, it says that the party it says that the period does not expire until the later of 30 days after that stay period. So as I understand 108C, it's a non-bankruptcy matter. The stay was lifted in 2013, and we filed within 30 days, which is what 108
but there's two
gives us.
There's two applications. We have our 30-day and the stay initially, and then we have the secondary part that 108C could extend the 90-day limitation period if it does not apply. But the question is that still applicable because we've gone past that 90-day?
Yeah, I think that, Your Honor, from the time that the bankruptcy is filed, the automatic stay is in place. And I think that the justices are struggling with that because as practitioners, we know that we can't do anything after the automatic stay is in place. And in fact, it is a debt of the debtor, so it becomes something that is automatically stayed. This whole case is a little bit moot, or this argument, because the creditor or the respondents here needed to file a motion with the bankruptcy court to lift the stay if they felt that the stay was not effective. And I cite to you St. Croix, which is a case that I put in my brief. And let me just read a little bit of what it says. It says, because it is the bankruptcy judge who is the most knowledgeable about the debtor's affairs and about the effect that any judicial proceeding would have on the debtor's reorganization, it is essential that he make the determination as to whether an action against the debtor may proceed or whether the stay against such action should remain in effect. So our position is the stay was in effect. They didn't move, and we're within 362 and we're within 108C, so we believe that there is jurisdiction. And then just going back to my last point, I wanted to read to you from the brief the language that Mr. Smith had set forth in his motion to set aside the default. He says, plaintiff's counter-defendants relied on their counsel, Christopher Rose, to represent them up until he was allowed to withdraw. An answer to the counterclaim was due before that time, as his firm was served with the counterclaim on December 10th. Defendant Tanya Demoff could not represent Financial Freedom Seminar System, LLC, because she's not an attorney who could represent a legal entity. Defendant Demoff could not obtain a copy of her file. Christopher Rose asserted a retaining lien on the law firm's behalf. In fact, an affidavit or declaration we filed wherein Ms. Demoff will state that she never received a copy of the counterclaim and was told by arbitrator Jay Young's office after March 5, 2009, the withdrawal of her counsel, that Jay Young could only speak to her attorney and not Ms. Demoff herself about this case. So I believe that that's good cause. I believe that the statute does not require, NRS 38 does not require that we oppose the motion to confirm, but simply by filing the motion to set aside the default, that becomes part of the record, and there is no waiver. And that would be our position. And we believe that there's jurisdiction because the bankruptcy court should have made the determination. It's not right and incumbent to put it on the Supreme Court of Nevada to interpret those statutes. Thank you.
Okay, counsel, thank you both. It's a very interesting argument, a little complicated, but interesting nonetheless. We appreciate you getting briefing on this. And the court will stand in recess. I think it's up to 2:30.